So last week we ended off. I left everyone on tenterhooks about this week's parsha with Shalach, with the spies, and so on. And I said we'd get back to it. So I do want to get back to it. So let's talk about the sin of the spies this week. There are a number of different approaches to understanding what exactly went wrong with the whole process of the Jewish people as they were about to enter the land of Israel. And we mentioned last week that the beginning of the end began already last week when the Jewish people left Mount Sinai and that intense relationship with God a little too eagerly, and that devolved into them complaining about the man, about the man, and then that one thing led to another, and we have this week the debacle of the sin of the spies. Briefly, the basic story as narrated by the Torah is that Jewish people come to Moshe and they tell him that they would like to send spies into the land of Canaan. How are you? Into the land of Canaan to spy out the land to get it ready for their invasion. And so they will check it out and be able to figure out the best way to invade the land of Canaan.
So they're
Yes.
just right on the other side of the river.
They were, yeah, basically on the border. Yeah.
They were on the border, but not on the same side as the Canaanites.
No.
They had to cross a river.
Well, okay, so at that point, they were not actually by the Jordan River. The Jordan River came much later,
Oh.
just a little bit of geography from a directionally impaired individual like myself. But the Jordan River lies to the east of the land of Israel. And to the east of the land of Israel is a country called Jordan.
Jordan.
Jordan. Egypt is to the west. Yeah.
Sorry.
So they would have gone into the land of Israel, straight from the Sinai Desert, okay, along, I think along the east or southeastern border. But because the whole thing blew up and they ended up being stuck in the desert for 40 years, they ended up circling around the southern part of the land of Israel, going around and up the eastern side, where they encountered the lands of Ammon and Moab, not to be confused with Moab and Utah, and just to the west, not to the east. And they conquered the kingdoms of the Amori, the Amorites, Sihon and Og. They conquered that, and that became what's called Eiver HaYarden. In English, it's called Transjordan. In modern times, it was shortened to be called Jordan, not to be confused with a famous basketball player of the same last name. And this is the country of Jordan today. So the country of Jordan is really what we know as Eiver HaYarden, the other side of the Jordan, where later on the tribes of Reuven and Gad and half the tribe of Manasseh would settle.
But
Okay.
they were Canaanites in
In that area, they were parts of the Canaanite nations. Keep in mind that the Canaanites is an overarching term for a whole bunch of different nations and city-states
But they
of
were
different.
called the Zorah.
They weren't. They weren't. They weren't good people. Yeah, I mean, they were a pagan idol-worshipping, human-sacrificing, incest-loving culture, as described by the Torah. So,
Was the young Hebrew nation strong enough if they had gone in right away? Were they strong
okay, so you
enough?
have to keep in mind that strength wasn't the question. The question was over here, support from God. Keep in mind that everything that's going on over here, right, is at the hands of Hashem. The young Hebrew nation wasn't strong enough to overcome Egypt, yet somehow Egypt fell, right? So we're talking about God waging war for them. And that's what we're going to try to focus on over here. So the Jewish people, getting back to our discussion, the Jewish people come to Moshe and they say, we need to send spies. And Hashem tells Moshe, this is not a great idea because I told you I'll take care of things. All right. If you've ever had the experience where you have someone, a friend, a family member who says, don't worry, I'm taking care of everything. And you keep calling anxious to make sure, did you think of this? Did you think of that? What about that? Are you coming? Are you there yet? Did you make tickets? What's going to happen? Besides being a nudge, right? The family member or the friend's going to get annoyed because like, don't you trust me? I told you I'm taking care of it. So either you don't trust me or you think I'm a nincompoop who's incapable of taking care of it. One of the two or both, right? So God says to the Jewish people, I told you I've got this and I'm God. Not me, is what God said. So, incapable is not an issue over here. So, you know, so this is in hand. Why do you need to send spies? And we'll try to talk about that. Why the Jewish people felt they had a need to send spies, but send spies they did. And God said, if you want to send spies, that's your decision. I don't think it's a good idea, but I'm not going to stop you. If that's where you're at and that's what you want to do, go ahead and do it. But says God, I'm just telling you, you're opening a can of worms over here. Okay. And so the spies depart to the land of Israel, to the land of Canaan, and they come back after 40 days. And as we know, 10 out of the 12 spies deliver a bad report about the land of Canaan, both in terms of the land itself, about the people living there, about the ability of the Jewish people to conquer the land. Okay. And they said that there are giants living there and they live in heavily fortified cities and people are dying left and right. So why do you want to go there anyways? And so on and so forth. And so the Jewish people panic and they say to Moshe, why did you take us out of Egypt to die at the hands of these Canaanites? Better we should have stayed in Egypt or at least died in the desert rather than us being killed in battle and our families taken captive by the Canaanites. And Moshe and Aaron and the only two spies who stay loyal, Joshua and Kalev, they stand up and they try to say, no, this is not true. We can, you know, God is with us and we'll conquer. And the people say, keep quiet. And they keep pushing. And the Jewish people say, let's stone them. And, at that moment, the Jewish people say, let's go back to Egypt. And at that point, God steps in and says, okay, you guys really screwed this one up. Yes.
I just wanted to say it was what they could, the things they did to support them, and they brought the biggest groups they could find.
Yes. Yes. So Dr. Kirschbaum points out that they brought back the largest fruits they could find. And if famous pictures, illustrative pictures you might have seen of these people carrying these enormous grapes on a latticework of poles. And you might have seen, people carrying these gargantuan figs and so on and so forth. So they brought back these gargantuan fruits. It should be pointed out, this is very parenthetical. Okay. But, for those who raise their eyebrows at these fruits, at these descriptions of fruits of biblical proportions, the term biblical proportions, right, that is used. Well, it is the Torah. The Talmud describes the fact that when the Jewish people are living in the land of Israel, so then the land of Israel produces. And when the Jewish people are in exile and they're not in the land of Israel, then the fruits are not as productive. And the reality is that for millennia, when the Jewish people were in exile and they were not working the land, Israel was basically a vast wasteland. Okay. For centuries, for millennia, that's what it was. It was described as such. Mark Twain famously, I think, visited there in the 1800s at some point. And he, described the fact that it was largely a wasteland and so on. And then with the return of the Jewish nation to the land of Israel, they quote unquote, what do they say? Made the desert bloom. Right. So, secular Zionists, dare I say it, say, look at our ingenuity. Look at our talents. We're so talented. We're so determined. We're going to make the desert bloom. The believing Jew says the land has welcomed back its people. God has welcomed back the Jewish people, the land of Israel. And so the land of Israel is again productive for its people. Okay. And this is when you have a secular state, not a Torah observant state. There's a lot of Torah going on there. Imagine if you had a fully Torah observant state, fulfilling the will of God, what kind of produce the Jewish people would merit then. Okay, so I just want to, that's a parenthetical comment, on the realities of the land of Israel even today. Yes, Marsha.
Israel now is so outstanding in technology. So would observant use that they're so...
I can't comment on, I mean, yes, Marshall points out that there's, Israel is known as the startup nation because everyone starts up with them. No, actually it's because startup nation, because they have so many startup companies and there's so much technology going on there and so on and so forth. So again, people like to ascribe this to Jewish ingenuity and talents and so on and so forth. You have to keep in mind that God takes care of his people, even in exile and even with all the problems. But historically, as going back to Mark Twain, although he was no Philo Semite, to be sure, but yet he himself had to, in his famous work on the secret of the Jewish people, had to grudgingly admit that the Jews have been fairly successful, and have left their mark despite having one hand tied behind their back for much of that time. So again, a secular Jew looking at it from the secular viewpoint of history can look at this and say, look how brilliant and ingenious and talented the Jewish people are. An observant believing Jew says, look at the miracle of how God has taken care of the Jewish people and the success that they have had and the ingenuity that God has granted them throughout the millennia. Okay, and so on and so forth. So, the miracle, there are authorities who say that the greatest evidence for God's existence and the chosenness of the Jewish people is the very fact that we're still around after millennia of everything that has gone on. So that's something to keep in mind as well. It gets me very bent out of shape when people talk about the Jewish people and the state of Israel as being this miraculous country that survives by its strength and its determination and its ingenuity, and somehow God gets left out of the picture largely. The word miraculous gets used, but without any connection to the source of the miracle. I get pretty bent out of shape when that happens. But that's just me. Go ahead.
What happened with Amalek?
That's later. What happened with Amalek is later. That's later.
But it's the same principle. I mean, if Hashem is protecting us,
yeah,
why is Amalek allowed to enter and do what he did?
Oh, you're talking about Amalek earlier when they left Egypt.
Both ways.
Yeah, no, because Amalek shows up in this week's parasha also. Yeah, well, the answer to that question is very clear, that the Torah itself alludes to it, but the answer is that the Jewish people at that point questioned their relationship with Hashem. They tested Hashem when they left Egypt with the lack of water and so on. They complained, and at that point, Amalek showed up. So Amalek shows up when the Jewish people's connection to Hashem are weakened. Amalek is like a bacterial infection. If there's a cut, it's going to infect. But if you keep things as they should be, so then they have no room to enter. Amalek is the personification of Satan, of evil in the world. Okay. The ministering angel of Amalek, Esav really, but Amalek is Esav condensed, if you will, is Satan himself. Okay. And the idea is evil gets in when you open the door for it, as Adam and Eve did in the Garden of Eden. You gotta open the door. If you open the door, even a crack. So then, he'll kick the door open wide. And that door has only continued to open wider over time. But that's not my discussion today. But that's where Amalek comes in. Okay, let's get back over here. So God comes and says to the Jewish people, to Moshe, okay, you guys really messed this up. You didn't trust me. I told you I'll take you into the land of Israel. And instead, here you are panicking, crying, making a big fuss. And because you failed to have faith in me, because you spurned me, because you didn't trust me, because you said, well, let's not go into the land and let's die in the desert. Die in the desert, you shall. And so the entire generation is doomed to die in the desert. And everyone, when they come of age of 60, will die in the desert. And the next generation, who were not party, at least not mature enough to be party to this terrible crime, they will go into the land of Israel instead.
That would be men only, not women.
Correct. The men only, not the women. You are correct. In fact, I did not see this myself, but someone told me that the Kli Yakar, who's a commentator on the Torah, says that, I think God hinted, I don't remember the exact details, but that God alluded or hinted to Moshe that he'd be better off sending women as, the spies to the land of Canaan than the men, because the women are reliable in this sense and the men are not. And you will notice this trend throughout history, that the women are the ones who keep the faith when the men fail.
So the women are honest and the men are lying?
No, I didn't say that. I said that the women are loyal. This is true, by the way, in general. This is true in general today, where the idea of male and female has largely ceased to exist in society at large. You are whatever you feel like being at any given moment. From minute to minute, a person can identify as this or that or both or everything or neither or whatever, and so on. But God did create a world, with men and women. And though it's politically unpopular to say this, each one has their, what we say in Hebrew, milus and chesroinus, their advantages and disadvantages. Okay. And so when you find descriptions of female foibles in the Talmud or in the Torah, or male foibles, or female strengths, a male strength. It's not being misogynistic or patriarchal or matriarchal, or there's a fancy word for anti-men. It's not misogynistic. There's a fancy word for it also. I don't remember right now. It is a description of reality. Wouldn't we all be better off if we understood a general sense of strengths and weaknesses instead of getting bent out of shape and saying, no, we can't do that. You have to make believe we're all exactly the same. So in general, women have a strength that they tend to be loyal, more loyal than men. That's true in relationships. Very often, men are the ones whose eyes are always wandering and who can't be trusted to keep faithful in the relationship. And usually the women are the ones who tend to be more committed. Talked about this last week already, and so on. Okay, and here's no different. When the going gets tough and the men are panicking, the women are saying, chill out. God will take care of us. Okay, so that's just another rant about society today. Anyways, moving along. So where did they go wrong? Where did the Jewish people go wrong? Now, of course, you could say, well, they panicked and they didn't trust in God. But whenever we discuss this generation, we need to understand that this is the greatest generation that ever walked the face of the earth. In terms of the levels of spiritual connection they reached, no other generation as a whole heard God speak. Okay, as an entirety, as an entire nation, no other generation can make that claim. This is the generation that received the Torah. This is the greatest generation. Okay, and yet they have some spectacular failures. But when we talk about their failures, we have to understand their failures always in the context of their greatness. This is not some petty failure that, you know, they got stuck in traffic and they got mad and panicked and started cursing the heavens because they're stuck in traffic or can't find a parking spot and they're going to miss their appointment or their flight. Okay, we're talking about great people who lived with God on a day-to-day basis. Every morning they woke up, there was food, manna rained from heaven. So God took care of them every day. In fact, what Mr. Kirschbaum pointed out before about Amalek, And the fact that Amalek, as I mentioned, Amalek came when the Jewish people complained or tested God. Okay, Rashi there, quoting a Medrash, I believe, gives a metaphor of a child, of a father who's carrying his child around on his shoulders. And every time the kid sees something he wants, he says, can I have that? And the father says, sure. And he bends down and picks it up and hands it to the kid. And then, can I have that? Yeah, here you go. And he hands it to the kid. And then after a little while, the father encounters the traveler, and the kid says to the traveler, excuse me, have you seen my father around anywhere? And the father says, what do you mean, have you seen my father? I'm carrying you on my shoulders. Everything you've asked me for, I've given you. And then you have the gumption to ask, where's my father? Let's see how you do without me. And he puts him down on the ground, and along comes a dog and bites the kid. So the metaphor is that God is carrying the Jewish people, so to speak, and providing for all their needs. And then, as soon as, you know, a little thing goes wrong, Jewish people are like, where's God in our life? God's like, where's God? Who's been taking care of you until now? Right? So let's see how you do on your own. If you think God's not here, fine. Be that way. God's not here. Let's see how you do. And then as soon as God lets go, because they've let go of God, so God lets go of them, right? Along comes Amalek. So where do they go wrong over here? How does a nation living with Hashem on a moment-to-moment basis, having witnessed these enormous miracles of going out of Egypt, of the splitting of the sea, of the plagues, of the manna, of the pillars of cloud, everything, all these miracles, where do they come up and say, Canaan, conquering Canaan? No, this is not going to happen. God can't do that. Why not? He did everything else. Why can't he do this?
Okay. Wasn't it mostly the people at the end who joined in making the troubles rather than the people who were going along with everything?
In this case, it doesn't seem like that. In last week's parsha, the Torah makes clear that the troubles of the complaining about the manna, the man, began with those add-ons, if you will, those you know, insincere converts who jumped on the bandwagon when the Jewish people left Egypt. The Torah says the asafsof. The asafsof means the add-ons. From the word asifa, you know, to add on, to gather in. Those who were gathered in, they kind of started that process, and the other, you know, and the rest of the Jewish people kind of jumped on. Over here, it seems like it was, you know, the Jewish people as a nation that kind of bought into this narrative over here of the land of Canaan being unconquerable. Okay, and the question is again, people, God has took out Egypt, the mightiest civilization of its era, of its time. He split the sea. He gave you food and so on. You think he can't conquer the land of Canaan for you? So what is happening over here? Yes.
They gave up hope real quick.
But why? That's the question. Why? Why? I mean, you witnessed all these miracles. So why can't you, you know, why? But I'm asking the question is why?
Maybe they weren't as sincere as we think.
Well, but why not? Put yourself in their shoes.
Well, maybe.
Even though you might be a wee bit smaller than they.
And
God said, I'm taking you to the land.
Yeah, I'm going to take you to.
So,
and it sounded like a good idea that something
wrong. But yet they panicked. Here they panicked. So why did they panic? Now,
and give up hope?
Yes.
Well, because they weren't that deeply sincere as God wanted them to be.
Okay, but again, we have to ask the question, why not? Where did they go wrong? Yeah.
They were worried that they would have to fend for themselves.
They were worried they have to fend for themselves. Again, but Hashem told them, I've got this. I'm taking care of this for you. Okay, very good. Okay, so you're making a point of it. So let's just talk about this, a few ideas for a minute, and then we'll try to zero in on an approach, you know, to understand. You find, even in the verses themselves, you find different ideas. Here and elsewhere later on when Moshe is recounting the events, you find different ideas of where the Jewish people failed and where they went wrong. Here, the failure seems to be that the Jewish people did not trust or believe in Hashem. Elsewhere, it says that they spurned the land of Canaan. Okay? They didn't want to go in. So here it sounds like they were panicking that they can't conquer it. There it sounds like they were nervous just about being there. They didn't want to go into the land. Forget about the wars. They just spurned the land itself. So which is it? Which, you know, some commentators point out that they were nervous about leaving their idyllic, completely supported life in the desert and going into the land of Canaan. But the verses don't seem to bear out that reality. You know, the verses don't make a mention of that. Some read between the lines. They didn't want to leave the desert and go into the land of Canaan. But again, why not? They knew this journey from Egypt through the desert was taking them to the land of Canaan. Okay, and in addition, as soon as God's finished chastising them and criticizing them and punishing them for their deeds, the nation as a whole sincerely regrets its actions. And in fact, there's a group of them who say, okay, let's go conquer it now. Right after the whole story of the sin of the spies, the very next section of the Torah talks about what's called the Mapilim. This group of people who said, okay, we messed up. Now we're here to fix it up. Now we're going to go and we're going to conquer the land and we're going to go ahead. And Moshe tells the Jewish people, bad idea, too late, you blew it, don't go, because you're going to get pulverized, annihilated. And they say, no, we're going. And they go, they get pulverized and annihilated. Okay, this group. So, you know, clearly the nation as a whole regretted its actions very quickly. Now, if they didn't want to go into the land, they wanted to stay in the desert because they're scared of going to the land of Israel. So where's the regret? You got what you wanted. What's the problem over it? Okay, so let's try to analyze these different issues and try to come up with an approach that we can try to understand over here. Okay, as was mentioned last week and a little bit already now, the life in the desert and life in the land of Israel would be very different. Life in the desert is going to be completely supported. They don't have to plow. They don't have to plant. Their food rains down from heaven every day. All their needs are taken care of. Last week we said, the Jewish people in the desert were very much like an infant being carried by its mother, being nursed by its mother, being cared for by its mother all the time. Okay? And so the Jewish people, the Torah itself compares the Jewish people to a child being carried around by its mother and nursed by its mother and cared for by its mother. That was the experience in the desert. In other words, they didn't have to do anything. They're like a little infant that is powerless and really is totally reliant on its mother for everything it has. Going into the land of Israel, those experiences are going to stop. Manna is not going to fall from heaven anymore. You're not going to have a cloud constantly leading you all the time. You're not going to experience the intensity of God's presence and that level of care and support from Hashem directly once you get into the land of Israel. You're going to have a massive shift and transition. You're going to have, as the verse later says, when finally, you know, the Jewish people reach the closest to a utopian society that humanity would ever reach when during the peak of the reign of King Solomon, of King Shlomo, after he builds the Beis HaMikdash, where every man was under his grapevine and under his fig tree but they were under the great point of the victory. In other words, they had to plant, they had to plow, they had to harvest, and so on and so forth. There was work to be done. They had to live a basic, seemingly normal life in an agrarian society of plowing the land and planting the land and working the land. That was the vision for the Jewish people in the land of Israel. That's what was supposed to happen. And the challenge would be to connect that very earth-based life with spirituality, with Hashem. A lot to talk about over here, but you may recall Adam is told by Hashem, by the sweat of your brow, you will produce bread. That is viewed as often the punishment for Adam for eating the tree, but in fact, it's the rectification. The ground from which Adam came and which he connected to by eating from the tree, instead of connected to his spiritual side, he lowered himself down to his earth, materialistic, physical side. God says, from the very ground from which you were taken, you will now have to engage and struggle with that. That's true physically. Those who are planting vegetable gardens this time of year, like myself, know it's quite a struggle. For every weed you pop up, another one happily pull out, another one happily springs up in its place, plus three more. So physically, that's true. By the sweat of your brow, you will eat bread, insects and weeds, and just the hassle itself of the plant. If you want to make bread, it's a multi-step process. Right? Talmud says that in the Messianic era, loaves of bread will grow straight from the ground. What's the idea? You have this vision of like, how's that going to look? You have like this shiny loaf of bread. The idea is that right now you have to struggle with that whole process of extracting bread from the ground. It doesn't end with the harvest. You've got to take it. You have to harvest it. You have to winnow it. You have to sort it. You have to clean it. You have to grind it. You have to knead it, bake it. All those areas of labor on Shabbos that you can't do are the process of making bread. That's a struggle. It's a long, lengthy, sweaty, sweat-inducing, tiring process before you can eat something. Right? In the Messianic era, the world will produce perfected food. Here you go. Right here. They call it breadfruit. The land of Israel are meant to perfect the world by engaging the land in the most spiritually connected place in the world, land of Israel. They're going to use that land to connect to spirituality, to Hashem. That's a big transition from the desert into the land of Israel. That's one piece that's going on over here. One piece. There's this nervousness about this transition. Okay? And the second piece that is going on is as follows. And as we'll see in a minute, these two pieces really, I believe, are one idea. And that is, the Jewish people say as follows. Hashem is all-powerful. He is omnipotent. He is omniscient. He knows everything, he can do everything, and so on and so forth. But we believe that. But what they didn't quite trust or believe was that God would choose to come through for them in the clutch. Okay? That was the question. Will God come through in the clutch? Okay? You have the petulant teenager going off to college. Anytime, who famously, when does he call mom and dad? He needs more money. Right, put more money in the bank account. Now there are credit cards already. But when does he call home? When he needs more money, or when he's in a mess and he needs mom and dad to come bail him out, literally or figuratively, from the mess. So, if the child knows that his parent loves him unconditionally, and will go out on a limb no matter what happens, so then the child, no matter what happens, the child is confident, is secure in the knowledge that mom and dad will always come through for me if I get into a mess. But what if the child, now here's the question, what if the child has had a somewhat strained relationship with the parent and has done a lot of stupid things, and the parent has expressed his or her, or their, both parents, their displeasure with the child's behavior. And now the child is wondering, there's a certain point where mom and dad are going to say, we can't save you every time because, you've got to live with your mistakes. You've got to deal with your mess ups. At a certain point, a parent is going to say, okay, I bailed you out enough times. I saved you enough times. Now you've got to stand up and deal with the consequences. Here's the great debate and dilemma of the Jewish people over here in the desert. The Jewish people know that Hashem is on their side. They know that Hashem has promised to take care of them. They know that Hashem has performed great miracles for them. However, they also know they've had a number of shortcomings and missteps that they've done over the last year or two during their journey in the desert that has perhaps put them on the wrong side of God. Maybe God's not so happy with them anymore. Maybe, despite God's promise to take them into the land of Israel, as he promised to their forefathers and foremothers, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, even though he promised them he would take them into the land of Israel, but maybe they ran afoul of God's goodwill. Maybe they don't deserve Hashem to save them anymore and to stand up for them. Okay? And here we come to the crux of the concern the Jewish people had. The question was not, can God do it? That wasn't the question. The question was, will God do it for us? Will he come through for us? Not can he, will he come through for us? Okay? This is a question that I think, I can speak for myself, but I think many people today struggle with. That as believing Jews, we believe in God's omniscient power. That's not the question. The question is, I don't know that God's going to perform a miracle for me, even a covert miracle, you know? And consequently, I need to put in my effort because I don't deserve miracles. If I don't deserve miracles, I need to engage in more normal, natural processes because God is not going to create supernatural miracles. He might be willing to allow things to run their natural course because I'm not deserving of those miracles. So here the Jewish people, when they come to the border of the land of Canaan, are faced with a crisis of confidence in themselves that extends to the relationship with Hashem himself. And that is, they say, we're not all that righteous here. We've messed up a lot. Hashem has punished us a bunch of times. Golden calf, last week with the complaining about the manna, all the other things that the Talmud says, that the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, that there were 10 times the Jewish people tested, challenged God. Okay, the sin of the spies being the 10th and final. Nail in the coffin. Okay, but 10 times they challenged God in the desert. Okay, as I mentioned last week, 10 mess ups during the course of 40 years is pretty good, quite good. Okay, but at their level, it was 10 too many. So here they are faced with a crisis of confidence in themselves by extension in their relationship with Hashem. We are not good enough, they say, to merit God's miracles, and therefore we're also not confident that God's going to step up and perform those miracles for us. We need to engage now in a more natural approach to warfare. So God says, don't worry, I'm taking care of you. And the Jewish people say, so you say, but how can we be confident that we will merit that level of divine intervention and protection to protect us through these wars against 31 kings in the land of Canaan? Keep in mind, it's a lot of like city-states in this country. So you have a lot of kings they have to wage war with. Who says we deserve that? And therefore, who says God will come through for us? Let's send spies. Because, yes, God says, you don't need to do anything. I'm taking care of this. But that was then. But this is now. And maybe we don't deserve. Maybe we need to engage in a more natural approach. Because God will not perform those kind of miracles that we saw coming out of Egypt. Maybe we have to put out more effort at this point. Because we don't deserve those kinds of miracles. And God says to the Jewish people, look, I promise you, I'll come through no matter what. Okay? Because God says, part of Hashem's promise is, even if you don't deserve it, I can still come through for you. And you need to trust me that even though in general, says Hashem, I deal with people in a reward-based system, okay, reward and consequence, I should say, based system, you get what you deserve. But here, I told you I'll do it regardless, no matter what happens. The Jewish people locked themselves into a system of reward and punishment and consequence and said, well, we messed up. So the consequence is God is not going to stand by our side. And God says, I am bigger than the system of reward and punishment that I created. Yes, I created a system of reward and punishment. And yes, in general, that's the system I abide by. But I'm not locked into that, says Hashem. I can do anything, including bucking the system I put into place. And if I say I'm going to buck the system and not go with a general usual system of reward and punishment, because I promised your ancestors that I will take you into this land, whether you deserve it or not, I'll get you across the finish line, then I will do it. You just have to trust me. And the Jewish people say, no, but reward and punishment, we don't deserve it. We don't deserve it. We have to act based on what we believe we deserve. They don't have confidence in themselves, and by extension, they don't have confidence that Hashem will come through for them. And so they send spies. And Hashem says, once you are tapping into that level of a world of of reward and punishment, a consequence, you're going to get stuck there. Be careful, because once you've descended into a world of putting in your own effort, of moving away from Hashem driving the ship, okay, taking care of everything, you might get stuck there. You might get very stuck there. You might descend pretty low down in that world, in that mode, and you might say or do things that you're going to regret later. But says Hashem, if that's what you want to do, if that's the approach you want to take, go ahead. You want to send spies? It's your call. You decide what world you want to live in. Do you want to live in the world of where you put in your own effort? Go ahead. If you decide you want to live in a world where I take care of everything, go ahead, and I will. But if you want to live in the world of natural consequences and rewards, go ahead. If that's your choice, you decide. You want to send spies? That's your decision. And the Jewish people send spies. And that decision leads these 10 great, who were previously great men, to come back and to scare them off and say, we can't conquer the land. And the way Rashi explains it, the Jewish people said that God himself cannot conquer the land. We mean God can't conquer the land. Did the Jewish people really just say that? That God is not capable of conquering the land after he destroyed Egypt, split the sea, gave them manna? The answer is, of course he can. But he won't, because we don't deserve it. So when they say that God is not mighty enough to conquer the land, what they mean is God within his system that he usually runs the world with, of reward and punishment, it's not going to work. We don't deserve it. God within that system is not going to be able to give us that protection because we don't deserve it. And God will not buck the system that he put into place of reward and punishment and come to our aid when we don't deserve it. So we're not going to be able to conquer the land. Tied into this simultaneously, in the same breath, is the realization of the Jewish people that once they go into that land, it's even more challenging because the whole dynamic changes. So in the desert, they live with Hashem constantly. Once they go into that land, everything changes. Now they're much more on their own than they were before. That's a scary, scary thought. Who says we'll be able to live up to it? Who says we'll be able to maintain an intense relationship with Hashem when he's not with us at our doorstep all the time, constantly around the clock? It's two different pieces that we started with. One piece, confidence in Hashem that he'll take care of them. Piece number two, a panic about the idea of going into the land of Israel itself. Okay? Both things are one and the same. That is, a lack of confidence in their own abilities to maintain a relationship with Hashem and to deserve Hashem's blessings now because they've messed up over the last year and moving forward because they won't be able to live up to the level that they live in the desert while transitioning from being carried around by God, so to speak, and taken care of constantly, to being more independent, being on their own. We talked about last week that this struggle is constant. You know, on the one hand, independence, on the like any child. On the one hand, independence, on the other hand, wanting support. That struggle is constant. And here it comes to the fore. Here it comes to a head. The Jewish people are nervous that Hashem will not stand by their side going into the land because they don't deserve it because of their past actions. And once they get in there, they're not going to be able to live up to the level they've lived in the desert because the whole dynamic changes. It's much more challenging. You're not going to be, so to speak, studying Torah and Kol all day when you're in the land of Israel. You have to be a part-time Torah scholar. Part of the day you're going to be working in the field, and part of the day you're going to go to the Beis Medrash. But that part of the day you're out in the field, it's not so easy to connect to God. You could do it. It's very doable. But it's not right there. It's not constant. It's not easy like it is in the desert. So again, lack of confidence in their ability to maintain that relationship with Hashem. And again, Hashem tells them that you don't trust me that this will work out. It's a lack of trust, that it's a lack of confidence in your own abilities that then becomes a lack of confidence in my abilities, says Hashem. That leads to these two errors. And this is where they go off the cliff. It's in that lack of confidence in themselves that extends into a lack of confidence in Hashem himself. That's where things go awry. Okay? So that is where the sin of the spies ends up manifesting itself. And Hashem says, okay, you chose this. You chose it. You decided that you cannot go into the land of Israel. You decided that you are not worthy to go in and have me stand by your side. You are that you were not confident enough in me, says Hashem, that I will stand by your side no matter what. Okay, so you'll die in the desert if that's what you want. If you are not confident enough to go into the land of Israel and live there and have and maintain a relationship with me and be assured that I will maintain a relationship with you and you will maintain a relationship with me, so then fine, stay in the desert. If that's what you want, that's what you'll get. Okay? So that is the story behind the sin of the spies. Now, this struggle continues, like I said before, until today, because we don't generally witness overt miracles. We do witness covert miracles sometimes. And our struggle in our lives with, is God really backing me up? Or is God, like, you know, leading me on my own? Is a question that many people ask on a regular basis when they are facing tough decisions or challenges in life or so on. And they're looking and saying, okay, God, are you there? Are you pulling me through this? Do I deserve your help? Are you going to answer me? Right? And they're waiting for that. Okay. Having that confidence that Hashem is there and will pull us through, even if there are struggles and challenges and difficulties, but he'll pull us through, is a struggle that people deal with on a daily basis today. And I believe, again, on very different spiritual levels, but the struggle itself is still there even today. Okay, so that's my piece for today. Yes, go ahead.
Good question. It doesn't seem like the end result would have been any different if 12 spies came back with a bad report.
As opposed to 10 spies?
Yeah, if 2 spies came back with a good report.
Okay.
So what is the positive impact in those 2 spies?
Okay. So, okay, that's a good question. So Bob is asking, just for those who are online, that what is the positive impact of the 2 spies, Joshua and Caleb, who did not give that evil report? I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know if they themselves had an impact on the Jewish people or if they mitigated in any way the damage that was done on a national level in terms of the Jewish people. Okay. However, Joshua and Caleb especially, was rewarded for remaining loyal despite the enormous pressure they were under from the other spies to toe the line that they had created. And they did not buckle to that pressure, and they instead pushed back in the other direction, you know, in support of Moshe and of Hashem and so on. So I'm not sure. It's a good question. And I've sometimes wondered about this a little bit myself. Like, did their actions have any impact on a national level? Not that I'm aware of. It's a little hard for me to believe that it didn't, but I've not seen anything that says that it did. For themselves, however, you know, it made a big difference. Kalev and Yeshua both would survive. Yeshua would later become the leader of the Jewish people. Not because of this. But he definitely demonstrated his leadership abilities in the sense of being able to stand up for what he believed was right, even in the face of a lot of pressure against him, which is a very important quality in a leader. King Saul HaMelech, King Saul, his demise would come because he caved to pressure from the people who wanted him to do something that he wasn't supposed to do. So that's an important quality in a leader. And Kalev would actually be given portions in the, both Caleb and Yeshua would receive the portions of the land of Israel that was supposed to go to those 10 men. They would get those portions of the land. Okay, so they were rewarded for that. Okay, and they become leaders of the Jewish people on their own. Okay.
Rabbi.
Yeah.
Rabbi. Okay, now at Sinai, when Moses did not come down, they fell apart. Our leader fell apart. How come they didn't rely on the leader at this time? It wasn't that long since they had that other incident. What happened?
Okay, that's a good question. There is a lot of talk about these two halves of these two, you know, massively catastrophic events, the golden calf and the sin of the spies, are actually looked at as two halves of the fall of the Jewish people. There were other events that went on, but these are the two halves. And there's a lot of talk exactly about what each half represents and where they went wrong and so on. I have seen and heard discussions about it, but off the top of my head right now, I don't have it arranged in my mind in a way or clear in my mind that I can give you a clear approach on that. But there is talk about it, that the golden calf was the beginning of the process and the spies was the end of the process. Two different mistakes that they made. I could just tell you one thought, but I don't have it really well developed. And that is that the golden calf was an error in God's ability to provide, and the spies was an error in their ability to receive. Okay, so as we discussed, it was, you know, a lack of their own confidence of meriting God's providence and protection that led them down this path over here. Okay. Anyone else?
Did you just say God made a mistake?
No, I didn't say that. I said the Jewish people made a mistake.
The one before that. You said Jewish people.
I said they made a mistake. By the golden calf, their mistake was in God's ability to provide. And by the spies, it was in their ability to receive.
Okay.
But like I said, that's not a developed thought because I didn't develop it. It's not well developed in my mind at the moment. So I can't, you know, Ethel asked me the question. So I'm just responding with a very underdeveloped thought.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Thank you all for coming. Reminder, if anyone would like to come to the West Side tomorrow for two great classes and a great lunch as well, starting at 10:30. Everyone's invited to that, to the West Side Call tomorrow. Okay, take care, everyone. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
Bye.